This is a HeadGum Podcast.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Hi, listeners. Friendly reminder that we now have a Patreon. If you like what you hear and want to support, go to patreon.com/girlsonporn.
Welcome to Girls on Porn. I'm Rachel.
I'm Laura.
And we love porn.
This is our porn review podcast.
We talk about what we love and we roast what we hate.
Helping you find hot, ethical, just plain better porn for your spank bank.
And we're looking at everything.
Today we are joined by an incredibly highly anticipated guest. You've heard his name a bajillion times coming out of our mouths. Justin LaMiller, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for coming on the show. For listeners who don't know, Dr. Justin LaMiller is a social psychologist and research fellow at the Kinsey Institute. He runs the Sex and Psychology blog and podcast and is the author of the popular book, Tell Me What You Want, The Science of Sexual Desire and How It Can Help You Improve Your Sex Life. Dr. LaMiller is an award-winning educator, having been honored 3 times with a Certificate of Teaching Excellence from Harvard University, where he taught for several years. He is also a prolific researcher who has published more than 50 academic works, including a textbook titled The Psychology of Human Sexuality that is used in college classrooms around the world. Wow, I'm impressed.
Yeah, well,
what can I say? I like to teach people about sex.
I love that.
What a great
quality. You've
taught
me a lot, I have to say. Good God.
It's true.
Justin, how did you get started as a sex researcher?
It was an accident. You know, it's not like I spent my whole life saying, hey, I want to be a sex researcher. So I was studying to be a social psychologist, and specifically my focus was on romantic relationships. Okay. And I didn't really have a great reason for that at the time, other than that I just thought relationships were interesting and it sounded like fun. And it was interesting as I was studying and learning about theories and models of like how relationships work and how you develop a happy, healthy, long-lasting relationship. Like, no one was talking about sex. And it was kind of weird. Sex is a pretty big part of most people's relationships. And so, you know, that was one of the things that kind of piqued my interest. But then along the way, I got assigned to be this teaching assistant for a human sexuality course. And that just like opened my eyes to this whole world of sex research that's out there. And I was learning about the work that Alfred Kinsey did back in the 40s and 50s and Masters and Johnson in the 60s and 70s. And I just thought that it was so fascinating, interesting, and important, and that there's so much that this work on sexuality can add to our understanding of relationships. And so that's kind of what pushed me in that direction.
Absolutely. That's fascinating. So would you say that you don't feel like you were always like interested in sex? It just kind of happened randomly.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't know much about sex growing up.
Yeah.
You know, it wasn't something. Yeah. I grew up in a relatively small city in Ohio and, you know, kind of conservative. My parents didn't talk a lot about sex. I went to Catholic schools for a lot of my upbringing. They didn't talk about sex there. So sex, you know, wasn't something that I thought you could actually pursue a career in, especially if you wanted to study it scientifically or teach people about it. Like, I never would have thought you could make a living doing that. So, you know, my career trajectory, I feel like, is very just fortuitous and accidental. And I couldn't be happier with how it ended up, but there was no grand plan to get here.
Right.
Well, what are some of the biggest surprises that you feel like you've encountered in your work, or even times when your own open-mindedness was challenged, like misconceptions maybe you had that you've learned from in your process?
Well, I would say early on, I was surprised a lot more than I am now.
Yeah.
Because, You know, given my background, I didn't know a lot about sex or mm-hmm. what people were fantasizing about or what they were actually doing behind closed doors. And so, you know, in the early days of being a sex educator and researcher, I was learning new stuff every day that was blowing my mind and drastically expanding, you know, my understanding of sex and relationships. You know, just as one example, as I was studying relationships in graduate school, there was sort of this presumption that everybody is or wants to be monogamous. And the more digging I did into that research, the more I started doing work in that area, the more I found there's a heck of a lot of people who are in sexually open relationships or are polyamorous or they're swingers or they're cuckolding. And, you know, for me, like that fundamentally changed the way that I looked at relationships. And then I started seeing the data on how your relationship can be open or monogamous and you can be just as happy, healthy, and satisfied. And there's nothing wrong with that. If something different works for you. So yeah, there's been a massive shift in the way that I think about sex and relationships because of what I do. And it just opened my eyes in so many ways.
Yeah. Mm. Can you talk to us a little bit about Tell Me What You Want, the book?
Your book.
Sure.
Your book. Your book, Tell Me What You Want. Because I love stats.
Yes.
I love stats so much. And so, and like, I get a lot of stats from this book because I'm fascinated by, like, you know, sexual desires and fantasies and things like that. But
so this book was a big labor of love. I spent about 4 years working on it.
Wow.
And it's based on the largest scientific study of sexual fantasies ever conducted in the United States. So I surveyed 4,175 Americans about their sexual fantasies. They completed a 369 question survey. The 69 was not intentional. It just kind of worked out that way. But I asked them about their favorite fantasy of all time, hundreds of people, places, things they might have ever fantasized about, and then wrote this whole book that does a deep dive into what are we turned on by and why, and what do our fantasies say about us, and how do you share your fantasies with the partner in a productive way, and what do you need to know if you're thinking about acting on your fantasies. So it's designed to be kind of a comprehensive guidebook to understanding your own fantasies, your partner's fantasies, and how to integrate them into your sex life.
I was going to say, it sounds helpful. Like it's, I don't want to say instructive because somehow that word has like a nasty stank on it I don't love, but that it's a guideline. It's helpful as opposed to just being like, here's the pure stats. Like how it sounds like a way to navigate your own fantasies that you might have your own judgments about potentially.
Yeah. And I mean, it was a challenging book to write in the sense that I have literally millions of data points from the study and I don't want to overwhelm people with stats. And so it was finding that right balance of here are the key stats that people need to know that they can relate to, help them better understand sexuality, but really break it down into what does this mean? How can you use this? So it was a challenging book to write, but I've been very gratified that I've had a lot of positive feedback on it. And a lot of people have said that it made them feel normal for the first time, or they shared their fantasies with their partner for the first time and had a really positive experience with it. So the feedback I've gotten from it has been really great.
That's amazing.
Wow. It's incredibly moving, genuinely.
Yeah.
It's really beautiful work to do.
Yeah. I guess kind of this might be a tough question, but do you feel like is there something that you found in your research or something that you believe, like if everyone knew about sex, like the world would be a better place or like sex wouldn't be so mystifying or stigmatized?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many things.
That's a tough question.
You know, this question or variants thereof, like what's like the one thing that everybody needs to know?
Who just and, feel like better about, you know, like sex in general.
If we're talking about fantasy specifically, I think one of the key things there is that the things that you're fantasizing about are probably the same things that most other people are fantasizing about too. And you're probably a lot more normal than you think. You know, the single most common question I get from people is, am I normal? Are my fantasies normal? Yes. Is my penis size normal? You know, all of these kinds of things come up. And so, you know, in the book, I give people a lot of information, not just about fantasies, but also about penis size and these other sorts of things, because we need to expand people's definition of normal.
Yeah.
So actually, I guess that's what I would say is that people tend to think of normal as being just this one thing or this one average. Like, so if you're having sex this many times per month or per week, like that's normal. And if you're doing it more or less, that's a problem or weird. So we need to rethink normal and pitch it basically as this range, right? So normal is a wide range of behaviors and numbers, and, you know, odds are you're probably normal. Right? Yeah, it's only when you're at the very extreme outliers that, you know, we can talk about something as being like uncommon or rare. And just because something is uncommon doesn't mean it's a problem, right? That doesn't necessarily mean it's a bad thing.
Exactly.
And that's really important when we're talking about fantasies, right? Just because somebody fantasizes about like being a furry or something else that happens with low frequency, that doesn't mean that there's anything wrong with being turned on by that.
Exactly.
And also just because a fantasy is common doesn't mean that it would be healthy or okay to act on, right? So, you know, one example of that is voyeurism fantasies. Voyeurism, by definition, is a non-consensual act because you're spying on somebody else who is undressing or having sex. And I find that most people in my survey say they fantasized about voyeurism before, but just because most people have done it doesn't mean everybody should go out and be a voyeur.
And that one in particular feels like one that you can resolve with certain resources, you know, like... I even think like the cam world could be conducive to voyeurism. Like if you want to feel like you're watching a girl all day long who doesn't give a shit about you, like there's someone for that, you know? So we should probably bring up and transition into the topic of the episode, which is, I mean, I do want to talk to you forever about all things sex research, but we'll have to rein it in and then probably bring you back again and again. But today we're here to talk about age play. Which is, I think, an incredible topic to be talking about with you. I think a heavily misunderstood kink.
You've been an expert witness in some court cases, right? About age play.
You'd be surprised at how often age play comes up in the legal system in court cases. And, you know, we might get into this more a little bit later. But, you know, one of the big issues that comes up... So for people who aren't familiar with age play, you know, it's this idea where people are role playing being different ages, and it could be one partner or both partners who are changing their age. But often it's one partner who's pretending to be younger than they really are, often somebody who is under the legal age of consent. And so there's sort of this, you know, sort of authority figure and or experienced teacher with, you know, the inexperienced younger person. So it's actually more about a consensual power exchange and establishing this dynamic than it is about an attraction to a specific age. But where it pops up in the legal system is that a lot of law enforcement agencies think that, well, even if it's just role play, you know, if you are having a sexual conversation with somebody who is posing as a minor, that necessarily means you're a pedophile and you're a threat to society and you're likely to molest children. And so that's where I often get involved in these cases, or where people will come to me, is to try and explain the sexual interest and what's the difference between age play and pedophilia.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And to be super extra clear for our listeners, when Justin, you're talking about younger than age of consent, we're talking about adults role-playing that they are children or they are minors.
Right.
And so that is the big distinction, is that it's consenting adults pretending that that gap exists, as opposed to actually that actual gap existing.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Or that lack
in
of
age
consent.
Play, there are no actual children involved.
Yes.
It's a consensual adult role-play scenario.
Exactly.
And it makes sense when you think about it as like plugging it into like already like a dominant and submissive relationship. Like that's a power dynamic we all know, right? It's like someone being older and someone being younger. And so when you plug it into BDSM, like, I'm like, yeah, that absolutely makes sense. Like, I would get why people would want to do that, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it sounds to me, and feel free to expound on this, Justin, so much about submission, in particular for, like, if we're talking about DDLG, like the little, often, you know, the little girl person role-playing that, so much about giving something up. I read an article in prep for this this episode from the Prostasia Foundation, which I'd never stumbled across before, but it was written from someone who professionally role-plays as a little. And she said something that just like resonated with me, that it's like taking your bra off and finally pouring that glass of wine at the end of the long day. Like, I'd never thought about it with that framing, that it's actually like a release into shedding a performative identity otherwise. Like, mm-hmm. I was kind of always thought about it as the reverse, right? That you're like performing this like little girl behavior. But something about like relaxing into that made a lot of sense to me, because I was like, yeah, I'm fucking tired of adulting.
Yeah.
You know, for lack of a better way of putting it, to get to like play in that little space just sounds fun, to like submit responsibility and let someone dominate you while still obviously having your cognizant like consent, yes, and your agency in this situation, to just, yeah, be like, I'm going to be a brat. And like, that's the game we play. Like, that, yeah, sounds great to me.
Yeah. To just not have to worry or have any responsibilities for a little bit. Like, what a break.
Yeah.
Well, and I think that's part of the appeal of so many different forms of role play, is that it's, yes, this escape from self-awareness. You get to step away from yourself for a while and become someone or something else temporarily. Mm-hmm. And there's all kinds of ways that we can transform ourselves in role play or in our sexual fantasies. But that sort of escape from self-awareness, shedding your identities, dropping your insecurities, anxieties, responsibilities, and temporarily inhabiting this other role, a lot of people find that to be a really exciting release, and they find that it relieves them of some burden. Mm-hmm. And also in the case of age play in particular, when you're kind of taking on this younger role, you can have a lot of fun with it.
Right.
and do things that you might not normally get to do in your daily life, because you have to adult,
yes,
during, yeah, that. So, yeah, that's certainly part of the appeal for some people.
Yeah, absolutely. I have some fun facts, because researching this, I started thinking about like the actual ages of porn stars. And so John Millward did this research of like the Internet Adult Film Database. And the average age of a MILF in porn is actually 33. Only 7%.
I almost spit my tea out on my keyboard. Only the average age of a MILF is younger than me. Cool. Yes, that feels great.
Right?
That feels right. Yeah.
Only 7% were over the age of 40, and only 4% were over the age of 50. Also, of the top porn stars of the year, this is from Pornhub's insights, in 2019, of the top porn stars, only a few women were over 40, including Lisa Ann, who's 48, and Brandy Love, who's 47, who are like two of the most popular MILFs of all time. A lot more men, interestingly enough. Johnny Sins is 42. Mandingo is 45, Manuel Ferraro is 45, Nacho Vidal is 47, and Rocco Siffredi is 56.
All these porn stars are listening right now and being like, really, you're going to call me out like that?
Sorry. I know.
No, I think we should destigmatize age in general. But
right, right. Those
are fascinating stats. And that's just a product of the porn industry being like any entertainment industry of valuing and
youth,
putting a superficial thing on youth, and then tossing out the rest in a really shitty way.
Right.
I think that is telling evidence that, you know, in something like MILF porn,
right,
it's not really about the age,
right,
of the actor. It's about, mm-hmm, the dominant role that she's adopting. And
absolutely,
I've seen content analysis of MILF porn compared to teen porn, and you see that women in MILF porn are more likely to be the initiators of sex and, mm-hmm, taking on a dominant role. And so it's really more about that power play than it is about age per se. But certainly, totally, the fact that, you know, you have so few women over the age of 40 in porn, you know, that's telling of something different that's, you, yeah, know, going, yeah, on in the industry and social and cultural values and the way that women of a certain age are devalued.
Right.
I have one other question for you, Justin. Because I'm not actually a psychologist, but I like to pretend, and I'm very fascinated by. So I'm curious, and I think this is sort of a dangerous question, so I want to phrase it carefully, but I think there's probably a societal assumption that the desire to, let's say, age play, but this could be true of any paraphilia, that the desire comes from some kind of trauma or experience as a child. And I'm curious how you engaged with that notion, or even like what stats or research you have that would sort of challenge it and even look at how it might be dangerous to make those assumptions or generalizations?
You know, I've seen some work looking at people who identify as adult babies, you know, which is a, you know, form of age play, where they're pretending to be infants or toddlers. And sometimes that goes along with diaper fetishism. And they've looked at, you know, what are the psychological roots of this? And what you can see is that in some cases, it relates back to an early experience they had. And sometimes it's related to a traumatic experience. And we see this with BDSM more broadly, that some people connect their interest in BDSM or age play to an early traumatic childhood experience. It could be physical abuse or sexual abuse. Now, so there is a link there, but it's small. And, you know, we need to be very careful to not assume that everybody who's into BDSM or everybody who's into age play has a history of sexual abuse or assault, because most of them don't. Right.
Yeah.
So while the link exists for a small number of people, that's not the predominant thing that draws people to it. So, you know, we need to be very careful in the way that we talk about trauma to not use that as a way of pathologizing these interests. Yeah. But we also need to recognize that for some of these individuals who have a history of trauma, they actually find age play or BDSM to be a therapeutic way of dealing with that previous trauma. And so it's not necessarily a bad thing or a negative thing. And so I just think we need to shift the conversation around this, because I hear a lot of people who, you know, are very vocal, very adamant, and want to say, you know, there's no connection at all between BDSM and trauma. But, you know, the reality is that there is. It's for a small number of people. But why do we want to erase or ignore their experiences and, you know, overlook the fact that this might be a therapeutic way that they cope with that trauma that they previously endured? So we just need to change the way that we talk about this.
I know. I find myself guilty of it too, where whenever we research a topic, I'm like, why is it hot? You know, like, we always want to look for like a hard and fast rule of what is it about this specific kink or fetish that people are attracted to. I don't know what that is, that we always want to know the reason behind it.
What I can tell you is that there's usually never just one hard and fast rule. You know,
that's what all those data points have to say.
If being a sex researcher has taught me anything, it's that sexuality is so complex, multi-determined. There are, you know, personality factors, the role of trauma, lived experiences, you know, partner-specific learning that you have. Your culture and society, our evolutionary history, like all of these things can come together to shape why we're turned on by certain things. So I try not to reduce it too much to any one thing. And say, hey, it's complex.
And also that people might not even be aware enough of their own issues or not even issues, but aware enough of their own psyche of like why it is hot. Like, why can't we just be like, yeah, I like it and I don't know why, and that's okay.
And, you know, it's also possible that we might overstate the role of trauma in some cases when it comes to how it relates to people's sexual fantasies and turn-ons, because when people have what they perceive to be an unusual sexual interest, they often try to connect it to an early life experience. And sometimes we're not always accurate at saying where our turn-ons or interests come from, or why we have the thoughts and feelings that we do. You know, introspection, you know, this idea of looking inward and kind of gaining self-understanding, it doesn't always lead to the right answer or conclusion. And so, you know, that's where therapy can come in terms of helping people to deal with this and recognize, you know, when they have attractions or turn-ons that are distressing or problematic to them.
I like your framing too, that what we should be focusing on is the like positive resource that BDSM provides, as opposed to this biased inquiry of like, this person has a paraphilia, or this person has a kink or something weird about them. Therefore, we have to look in reverse, like retrospectively look for a problem in their childhood, as opposed to just saying that this like kink or this fantasy or this fetish exists and these are the million reasons why. But isn't it great that they can act on them and that those fantasies can provide pleasure and an outlet of all kinds to that person?
Yeah. And I mean, another way of thinking about this is like, there are a lot of people who are into vanilla sex who have a history of trauma, but we're not looking at, you know, we're not trauma as like, a why? Problem for them.
You have vanilla sex, so like it must be because your mother didn't love you.
Yeah,
like,
where does that come from?
Yeah.
It says much more about the way that we shame and stigmatize any form of sexuality that seems outside the norm or beyond what we've been taught is normal human sexual behavior. So I think that's really more the issue than anything. And that's part of the reason why I do the work that I do is to help people to understand diverse sexual interests. And the more that we understand them, we can destigmatize them, reduce a lot of that shame that is ultimately like the source of so many of our sexual problems.
Totally. Same with us. I mean, that's the reason why we do the podcast, you know. Mm-hmm. It's because we live in a shame-based society, unfortunately, but not if we have anything to do with it.
Not if we have anything to say about it.
Yeah.
Doing our part.
Yeah.
Well, shall we take a quick break and we can come back and talk about those videos?
Sounds good.
This HeadGum Podcast is brought to you by Aura Frames.
That is right.
From grandmothers to new mothers, aunts, even the friends of your life, every mom loves an Aura Frame.
Holy shit, even aunts?
Yes, especially aunts.
Oh, well.
Because it was named the best digital photo frame by Wirecutter and selected as one of Oprah's favorite things. I mean, these Aura Frames are guaranteed to bring joy to moms of all ages.
I believe it.
You have an Aura Frame, don't you?
Yes, I actually more than believe it. I know it. I've got one for my mom, my mother-in-law, my grandmother-in-law.
And dare I say, your aunt?
And dare you say, my aunt and my aunt-in-law. Everyone's got one. Everyone loves them.
I mean, Mother's Day is right around the corner, and there's no better gift than a digital photo frame. You give them the frame. It's got preloaded pictures in there. And you know what? You can update it with an app. So every time you take a new picture of a sweet little person or place or thing in your life, it gets automatically sent to that frame.
Exactly.
And right now, Aura has a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. Holy smokes.
Excellent deal.
Yeah, that's AuraFrames.com. You use the code HEADGUM at checkout to save.
HEADGUM. Nice.
Yes. HeadGum. It's easy to set up. It's loved by everybody, including Oprah, including your aunt. Mm-hmm. So do check them out. That's AuraFrames.com. Use code HeadGum at checkout to save.
Damn right.
And terms and conditions apply, of course.
Of course.
Thanks again to Aura.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective, unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
And we're back. We are back. We're back to talk about porn. Fancy that. So the first video that we're going to talk about is from Pink Label. It's hosted on Pink Label. It's from Bonus Hole Boys, featuring James Darling and Alan Silver. And I was really excited to talk about this because I know James Darling's work and we haven't really talked about him yet on the show. So this is exciting to get an opportunity to talk about his work. He has his own platform as well called FTM Fucker, but this is from Bonus Hole Boys. Mm-hmm. Quick little log line. College freshman James Darling thought he could have a moment alone in the bathroom, jacking off to a porno mag, but then dad's friend, Alan Silver, interrupts right before he's about to bust a load. What starts off as an awkward moment turns into an intergenerational FTM fuckfest with dirty talking, ass-eating, long blowjobs, daddy boy play, and deep penetration. And this is
Alan
like,
Silver, important to know that Silver is a self-proclaimed mega dad, which I loved.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's from Alan Silver's Twitter. I was like, I like that terminology. Yeah.
And this was fun. I mean, just because the topic, like, obviously there's a spectrum of age play. So this is like, you know, it's age play, but it's not like James Darling isn't playing that much younger than he actually is. So we're talking like college freshmen, which would be like what, like 18, 19.
Yeah. It feels in the realm of like gay daddy porn, you know?
Yeah,
it's right. We've got our daddy, but we're not necessarily dealing with a minor, different forms of age play again.
Yeah, right.
So we start with James masturbating to a porno mag, a gay one, important to note.
Yeah.
And then Alan Silver walks in on him and then leaves. And what I thought was kind of a mysterious move, James just continues masturbating.
Same.
I was like, oh, yeah, interesting. And then we cut to the next scene where Alan Silver's like, we should maybe talk about what just happened. So there's no like awkwardness. If you're going to be staying with me, we need to be able to talk about stuff. And then very quickly pivots to like, have you masturbated about me? And then that leads us into like the sex scene.
Right. A natural progression.
It did feel like a very sudden, like, we're going to fuck. And I was like, oh, okay. We just like went there. But I did sort of like that we started with the authoritative yet like considerate dad figure.
Right.
And then just like flipped it on its head, you know?
Yeah. I actually really loved that. I love that he was like, yes, let me make a safe space for you to talk about your sexuality. You know,
yeah.
Like you're allowed to talk about this stuff with me. I loved that.
Everyone
you don't really
likes
see that.
Porn with a plot and a positive social message. So,
yeah. Right. Like it made me feel nice. Like it wasn't like you were bad. You were looking at porn now, which like in the mainstream version of this would be like, now I'm going to punish you. It was like, let's talk about this, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And then also, would you like to give me a blowjob? And James was like, absolutely, I would. Yeah, it was like lots of good communication. I really enjoyed that.
I also really like the dynamic of this. Like it leans into the stuff that we were talking about earlier about like power play. And Alan is definitely the daddy figure here, like uses the word like son about a million times.
Yeah.
And a lot of like positive encouragement, like, oh, you're really, what is the line that he used during the blowjob? Like, you're really taken to this. Like,
you're really taken to this.
Yeah, like something like hokey about it. Like, oh, yeah, you're really taken to this blowjob. Like, good job, son. Like, it could have been like a baseball lesson, you know?
Like, yeah, totally. I was like, sir, this is not his first time.
I mean, I thought that was particularly interesting. Like, when we were talking about age play earlier and the, you know, power play and dominant submissive aspect, you know, there wasn't like hardcore power play here. You know, this was, there was a lot of nurturance, a lot of encouragement, a lot of validation.
Yes.
Right. And so it was this very kind of warm form of age play that, you know, contrasts with a lot of the other stuff that's out there where it's, you know, very strict dom sub roles.
Or more like punitive, like more around the narrative of like, you did something wrong and you have to be punished and it's a sexual punishment and that's the role play or that's the story of the porn where, this was much more like, nurturing.
Yeah.
it was very warm.
It was lovely. It was really lovely.
Yeah.
It was also like a lot of like laughing too, which made it feel like they were genuinely enjoying themselves. I did love the fact that there was a periodic table of elements poster on the background. I couldn't take my eyes off of that at one point. What else? Yeah, I just really liked it.
Yeah.
I mean, I think the laughter piece is really interesting because there are so many people who say, like I've heard people say, including therapists, like you should never laugh during sex. And, you know, so there's so many people who just like, they approach sex so seriously and they're afraid to laugh. But you're allowed to have fun with it.
It's
okay to laugh as long as you're laughing together and not, you know, laughing at the other person.
Yeah, we talk about this constantly. Like
I have said before that I think sex is serious. And there
Rachel and I have like gone toe to toe on this before, but Rachel's been like, it's serious. My body is sexy and it's serious. And I'm like,
well,
if we're fucking and my farts make a, like, or my tits make a fart sound, like we got to acknowledge
it.
Otherwise it's like a weird lie. Like we're laughing,
right.
But you can also just like have fun inside of the play. And I also like that this scene in particular is another example. And we've seen a few before that I think are great that role-playing or dominance play or BDSM of any kind doesn't always have to be hardcore. Doesn't always have to be rough. Doesn't have to be punitive. Like it can be. And by all means, if that's your thing, go for it with a consenting partner, but it's nice to see an alternative and to show the spectrum of yes. pleasure that can be inclusive, not just of pleasure pain, but also of something more playful and laughy and fun like this is.
A teaching moment, some might say. Yeah, it was great. It turned me on more than I thought it would. The licking of the armpit, especially, something you don't see enough in porn.
You love that.
I did. I really liked that. Because it's like, it's an erogenous zone that I think a lot of people forget about. You know?
Yeah.
Love a good armpit lick.
Another highlight for me, there was some serious face fucking with James on top of Alan that I like looked away for a second and came back and was like disoriented to the point where I was like, oh, is this fucking? Because it was such like enthusiastic grinding that James was doing on Alan's face. And I just really liked that because something about it like played into the dynamic that I was like, Alan can handle it, you know? Like I liked that James was getting so into it and that we were seeing that kind of engagement and that it felt like vigorous, but also it was like, dad's okay. He'd let you know if not. It, like something about that like felt like it lent itself to the dynamic of their relationship in the video.
Yeah. And important to note, we get an exit interview, which I always think is very important in porn. Love to hear
that was interesting to watch.
Yeah.
You know, you don't see that happen very often at all,
right.
But to get sort of the inside perspective of, you know, what were you thinking? And kind of how do you feel about performing these scenes? What's the way that you approach them? I think it's fascinating and can add a lot of context.
Oh, absolutely.
To, you know, the video that you just watched and then what you take away from it. Cause I think people have all of these ideas about porn stars and how porn works that are just totally wrong.
Absolutely.
And they don't even really see them as real people.
Right. Yeah.
With real emotions and feelings. And so it adds something else that's different and so personal. And I think it'd be interesting to have a component like that in a lot more of the porn that's out there.
Right.
Right. Yeah. We love to see it. Cause it, like you said, it reminds the viewer that the people you're watching are human. Like I think so often the experience of watching porn can be really bizarre. Like you come and then you sort of like come to, and I think the joke that everybody tells is like, ugh, like you're like put off by it. Like the thing that you were just coming to, cause it can be intense to watch. And I think seeing that the performers are people again, actually humanizes
Absolutely.
The experience of watching porn and makes it all feel normal and safe. Like for me, I love to see it because the biggest thing that distracts me is when I feel like I don't know if the performers are okay or if I don't know if consent is present. It's a huge turnoff and it's really scary. So any reminder of like, these are humans and they're making a living and you're turned on by it and it's all fair game is great.
It also reminds us that it's a performance.
Yes.
You know, like it isn't reality.
It's a space for fantasy too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I was also going to say, it's also kind of like a form of aftercare
well, 100%.
Where that kind of happens and you get to see them interact. And, you know, the other nice thing about porn not ending on the male orgasm is that it doesn't reinforce this idea that a man's orgasm is the end of a sexual encounter and that orgasm is the ultimate goal of sex, right? I think by having so much of the porn out there end on a male orgasm, it just reinforces some problematic ideas that we have about sex.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So the next one is Poppy Cox and Susie Q in the standby classic Crash Pad series.
Right.
And this one is a different form of age play.
We actually had Susie Q on to talk about DDLG. So it was really it was awesome to see her actually in like a little space, you know, as a performer.
Yeah. And this one's unusual. It's like it's sort of a twist on age play. It almost skirts the category just a little bit because it's Poppycock's role playing that she's a doll and then Susie Q role playing as the little girl, which is an interesting, it sort of adds another element, but feels like its own version of age play, particularly from Susie.
Yeah. What's interesting to me is that it's like what traditionally we would think like the little girl is the submissive. She's actually quite dominant in this scene, which I liked.
Yeah.
Well, there is also that other element where the camera cuts out a couple points to some male viewer who's watching this on like a camera. And, you know, I don't know if that's like supposed to be the daddy who gave the doll to the girl and like he's watching it. So there's, you know, so when I was seeing that, I was thinking there's also this voyeuristic element and, you know, is that supposed to be the daddy figure in this? Yeah. And is that another layer to the age play?
Yeah. That's such a fascinating interpretation.
Yeah.
the funny thing about Crash Pad is that for a lot of their earlier work, that voyeur figure is there for all of the videos and the, like we cut back to him in all videos. And at some point they shedded that and we're like, we don't need this guy here.
It's not a guy. It's Shine Louise Houston.
Or sorry. Yeah. It's Shine Louise Houston. So it's the creator of Crash Pad, like that we go back to and just have a reminder of like that voyeurism. So in this case, it's not necessarily the gifter of the dolly, but I actually really like that read because it sort of like does enhance the porn if you can like view it through that lens. That's funny. Yeah. That's really interesting.
Yeah. Well, as a naive viewer, that's I'm not familiar with the company. Yeah. So that was the other layer that I was interpreting. And I think that, you know, that just speaks to how porn can be interpreted by different people in so many ways. Mm-hmm. And it's always fascinating to look at, you know, not just what people count as porn, but what are they perceiving and taking away from it?
Totally.
You get different answers from everybody.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Lots of great kind of like bratty little girl play in this, you know, like pulling of her hair, taking her clothes off, spanking her with a candy. This is Susie Q as being kind of like a dominant little girl. And I loved it. I mean, the thing about that, like, I forget sometimes about like child play is that it is kind of like kids can be like bratty.
Well, weirdly, that's the part that like sounds the most appealing to me about like age playing as a little, like as someone without experience doing that. I don't want to speak out of turn, but I'm like, yeah, it sounds fun to get to just like role play being a little girl again, or like being a brat and again, like shedding some of the like adult qualities that we have to inhabit in our daily lives. Also, just to sort of like run through the whole video. I think, I imagine this was improvised. Like it didn't feel scripted. It just felt like play.
Totally.
And I think Susie does some great stuff to lean into again, that dynamic of being like, oh, I'm going to take your dress off. Like a lot of things she does feel like they're inside of a game with a doll, and she finds creative ways to make them sexual or for the doll to engage sexually. Like they have like they talk about like sparkles, and she refers to both their genitalia as like kookas, which I was like, that's a that's a nickname for a cunt I've never heard before, but I really like it.
But like absolutely would be something that like you know what I mean,
that like a little girl might be given as like a euphemism for her own vagina. Like, oh, like your kooka's not for other people. Like that kind of
don't
stuff.
Don't forget to wash your kooka.
Yeah, exactly. You know? Exactly.
You know.
She said something about like not getting sugar around, like sugar's bad for kookas.
Yeah.
And I was like, that's true. And not a lot of people know that. Yeah. Like leads to yeast infections. Let's talk about it.
I know.
Again, that's a different episode.
I'm learning.
Hey, more positive social messages from porn.
Yeah, exactly. That's what we're here for.
That's what we're always looking for. Yeah.
And then, I loved that they brought out so many other props and toys, too. There were clamps.
I was going to say, like clothespins and like little clamps. And all of those props felt like they were in the world of this little girl, which I thought was a lovely touch. Yeah.
We had a dildo. And of course, the queen, Hitachi Wand.
Queen, Hitachi Wand. She showed up and I just was like, it's our old friend.
Yeah, there she is.
Yeah.
And then what I loved was that it was like the doll didn't come to life until she came. Susie Q like made her come, and then it was like, oh, she was like, now you're coming to life.
Now I'm a real girl.
Yeah,
like, what an awesome take on Nutcracker /
like, Pinocchio. Yeah.
Like any doll narrative.
I was also thinking like it's like the porn age play version of Mannequin, like where
deep cut. I love that.
yeah, that's hot.
But there was also so much more BDSM in this one compared to the other video, where you know there was the candy ball gag.
Yeah, I was gonna say
by a lollipop, and there was some choking, and the you know clothespins used as nipple clamps and clips on the labia, and so like there was so much more of that pleasure and pain, sadism, masochism, and dominant submission in this, and then it was really fascinating when the doll comes to life, and there's the role reversal, and then the doll becomes like the dominant figure.
Yeah.
And it was just fascinating to watch like that shift in evolution and the switch that happens.
Yes.
Yeah.
All both being little girls, you know, both, you know, age playing.
Yeah. I thought they both were fabulous performers in this too. Like the doll role for Poppy could potentially be like an underused thing. You know, she could have just kind of been like, just sort of a stick figure throughout, but like weird little choices I was really into. Like when Susie like took off her top the first time and exposed her like real breasts as opposed to her like suited breasts.
Yeah.
She like had like a really big, like almost like clownish expression response to it. And I was like, this is correct. I love the like clown doll dynamic.
And lots of like a natural feeling of exploring, which is again, like so childlike.
Yeah. Well, snaps.
You know, something I was thinking of is it was almost sort of like how kids play doctor with each other a little bit, but also how a lot of kids, you know, have dolls or action figures and they undress them to see what's underneath.
Totally.
And so it's like, I'm thinking about sort of like how they're taking those elements and incorporating them here. But also, you know, one other thing I noticed was, like the previous video, there was also a lot of warmth and nurturance
where,
you know, they're saying things like, you're doing so well and you smell good and you taste good. And like, there's all of this validation and encouragement and so forth. So, you know, that was there alongside the, you know, more intense BDSM elements, but, you know, accompanied by that very nurturesome component.
Right.
Yeah.
Very warm.
Yeah.
Made me feel good.
We don't always do this, but we purposefully went with like two videos that showed the spectrum of this kink without going for the problematic option. Like often we'll pick something to sort of poke fun at, but this one, it felt right to just like look at different aspects of how this can be effective and how it can be safe and consensual and fun.
Yeah.
As opposed to deep digging into the like seedy underbelly of porn and what we might find in the age play realm there. Because it could have gone real dark. It could have gotten scary and we don't want to promote anything non-consenting. Like we poke a lot of fun, but this, because there's so many misconceptions about this particular arena, we really just wanted to illuminate the positive here. So both really like fascinating great videos. I
also loved at the end of the crash pad one that she was like, okay, you can't tell anyone, which is like absolutely like a kid thing to do, you know. It's like or like you'll get sent back to the factory, and then like Poppy was like, I want to stay with Susie. Like it was I loved it. I thought it was great. I mean, normally we ask like which ones are going into our spank bank, but you know, I think it's safe to say I liked both of them.
She greedy.
I liked them both, I'll take them both.
I do think these are both winners for me. Like both really strong,
And like
creative videos,
great examples of like communication and just that like age play can be something that you can watch and support without being like, am I normal?
Well, thank you so much again for joining us, Justin. It has truly been our honor to have you on with us.
Thank you for having me. And I've never been assigned like porn homework before coming on a podcast. So thanks for that. And I had to stay up last night and have a drink and watch some porn.
Oh, I'm so glad.
To get ready for today.
What a thrill to give you a first. That's not something we expected to be able to do.
I know. Cool.
Yeah. Like I said, it's hard to surprise me or shock me or do anything at, you know, at this point in my career, but you know, I'm always down for new experiences. So. Yes.
And before we sign off, anything you want to plug, handles, books, etc.
For people who want to learn more about my work or follow me, I run the Sex and Psychology blog and podcast at sexandpsychology.com. You can also follow me on the social medias. All the links are on my website, but I'm on Instagram at Justin J. Lehmiller, L-E-H Miller. And you can find my book, Tell Me What You Want, anywhere books are sold. You can get the audiobook if you want me to read it to you personally, or you can get it in paperback, hardcover, whatever format pleases you.
Awesome. I think I just learned I've been saying your last name wrong.
I know.
It's Lehmiller, not Lehmiller. Lehmiller.
It's Lamiller. I get Lamiller a lot, but okay. I'm not super picky about that.
Well, now we know, and we'll say it correctly forever. We just have to make up for at least 100 episodes where we have said Lamiller. But...
Oh, again, always learning.
Oh, amazing. Thanks so much for listening to Girls on Porn. You can find us on Instagram at Girls on Pern. That's porn without the O. On Twitter at GOP the podcast. On our website, girlsonporn.com. And now on patreon.com/girlsonporn.
Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe to the show if you haven't already. And hey, why not take a look at our Patreon? I bet you might find something you like.
This has been Girls on Porn, the only GOP that's actually good.
That was a HeadGum Podcast.